Chapter 22. Behind him was black darkness. Ahead, the sparsely scattered streetlights of Gao. Gunn still had 10 meters to swim when one of his kicking feet dug into the soft riverbed. Slowly, very cautiously, he reached down and grabbed the silt with his hands, pulling himself through the shallows until he was lying at the waterline. He waited, listening and squinting into the darkness shrouding the bank of the river. The beach sloped at an angle of 10 degrees, ending at a low rock wall that bordered a road. He crawled across the sand, enjoying its heat against the wet skin of his bare arms and legs. He stopped and rolled onto his side, resting for a few minutes, reasonably secure that he was only an indistinct blur in the night. He had a cramp in his right leg, and his arms felt numb and heavy. He reached back and felt the backpack. For a brief instant, after he had struck the rushing water like a cannonball, he thought that it might have been torn from his back. But its straps still clung tightly to his shoulders. He rose to his feet and sprinted in a crouching position to the wall, dropping to his knees behind it. He warily peered over the top and scanned the road. It was empty. But a badly paved street that ran diagonally into town had a fair amount of foot traffic. Out of the upper edge of one eye, he caught a dim flare and looked up on the roof of a nearby house in time to see a man light a cigarette. There were others, dim figures of people, some illuminated by lanterns, happily chatting with their neighbors on adjoining roofs. They must come up like moles, Gunn surmised, to enjoy the cool of the evening. He studied the stream of the pedestrians on the street, trying to absorb a rhythm to their movements. They seemed to glide up and down the street in their loose, flowing garments on silent feet like wraiths. He unstrapped the backpack, opened it, and removed a blue bedsheet. He tore part of it in a crude body pattern and then draped it around himself in the style of a jalaba, a long-skirted garment with full sleeves and a hood. He wouldn't win a local fashion award, he thought, but felt reasonably satisfied it would pass unnoticed in the dimly lit streets. He considered removing his glasses, but decided against the idea, positioning the hood to cover the rims. Gunn was nearsighted and couldn't see a moving bus 20 meters away. He slipped the backpack under the robe and strapped it around his front as if it was simply a protruding stomach. He then sat on the wall and swung his legs over to the far side. He casually stepped across the road and up the narrow street, joining the citizens of Gao who were out for their evening stroll. After 2 blocks, he reached a main intersection. The only vehicles prowling the streets were a few dilapidated taxis, 1 or 2 run-down buses, and a few scattered motorbikes and a bevy of bicycles. It would be nice to simply hail a cab for the airport, he thought wistfully, but that was inviting attention. Before abandoning the boat, he had studied the map of the area and knew the airport was a few kilometers south of town. He considered stealing a bicycle, but quickly eliminated the idea. The theft would have probably been noticed and reported, and he wanted no trace of his presence known. If the police or security forces did not have reason to think there was an illegal alien wandering in their midst, they would have no cause to search for him. Gunn leisurely walked through the main section of town, past the market square, the decrepit Hotel Atlantide, and the merchants hawking their wares from stalls under arches across from the hotel. The smells were anything but exotic. Gunn welcomed the breeze that fanned most of the town's odors into the desert. Signposts were non-existent, but he navigated down the sandy streets by occasionally glancing up at the North Star. The people dressed in a blaze of green and blues and a smattering of yellow. The men were dressed in some form of jalaba or caftan. A number wore western pants and tunics. Few were bareheaded. Most male heads and faces were heavily swathed in blue cloth. Many of the women were covered in elegant cloaks, others long flowered dresses. Most all were unveiled. They all chattered constantly in strange low tones. Children ran everywhere, no two dressed alike. Gunn found it hard to imagine such social activity and congeniality in the middle of great poverty. It was as though nobody informed the Malians they were poor. Keeping his head down and face covered by the hood so the white skin of his face wouldn't show, Gunn merged with the crowd and made his way out of the busy part of town. No one stopped him and asked awkward questions. If, for some unexpected reason, he was apprehended and interrogated, he would claim to be a tourist on a hiking trip along the Niger. He did not dwell on that possibility for long. The danger of being stopped by someone who was looking specifically for an illegal American was nil. He passed a road sign with a pointing arrow and a drawing of an airplane. He was making his way toward the airport easier than he expected. His luck hadn't skipped out on him yet. He walked through the more affluent merchant-owned neighborhoods and into the surrounding slums. From the time he left the river, Gao had given him the impression of a town where, with the coming of darkness, some unseen horror crawls up through the sandy streets. It seemed to him a town drenched in the blood and violence of centuries. His imagination began to work overtime as he walked the dark and nearly deserted streets, beginning for the first time to see curious and hostile looks from people sitting in front of their crumbling houses. He ducked into a narrow alley that looked to be empty and paused to take a revolver from the backpack, an old snub-nosed Smith & Wesson 38 caliber bodyguard model that had belonged to his father. His instinct told him that this was a place you didn't walk at night if you expected to see the dawn. A truck rumbled past, stirring up the fine sand, its flatbed piled with bricks. A quick realization that it was going in his direction and gun threw caution to the desert winds. He took a running leap and scrambled up the back of the truck. He came to rest flat on his stomach on top of the bricks, facing forward and looking down on the roof of the cab. The smell of the exhaust from the diesel engine came as a relief after the aroma of the town. From his vantage view atop the truck's cargo, Gunn picked out a pair of red lights blinking a few kilometers ahead and to his left. As the truck bounced closer, he could see a few floodlights mounted on a terminal building and two hangars across a darkened field. "Some airport," he muttered to himself dryly. "They turn out all the runway lights when it's not in use." A dip in the road showed in the truck's headlights, and the driver slowed. Gunn took advantage of the decreased speed and hit the ground running. The truck rolled on into the darkness, sand streaming from its tires, the driver blissfully unaware he'd carried a passenger. Gunn followed the truck's taillights until he came to an asphalt side road and a wooden sign painted in three languages that advertised the Gao International Airport. "International," Gunn read aloud. "Oh, how I hope so." He walked along the side of the entry road, keeping off to one side in the remote chance a vehicle might happen by. There was little need for caution. The airport terminal was dark and the parking lot totally empty. His hopes took a downturn at a close-up view of the terminal building. He'd seen better-looking condemned warehouses than the wooden structure with a rusting metal roof. It took a brave man to climb and work in the nearby control tower, sitting precariously on support girders that were almost eroded through. He walked around the buildings onto the dead and darkened tarmac. Across the field, illuminated by floodlights, sat 8 Malian jet fighters and a transport plane. He stood motionless as he spied 2 armed guards sitting outside a security shack. One was dozing in a chair, the other was leaning against the shack smoking a cigarette. Great, he thought, just great. Now he had to contend with the military. Gunn held up his Chronosport dive watch and peered at the dial. It read 11:20. He suddenly felt tired. He'd made it this far only to find a deserted airport that looked as if it hadn't seen an arriving or departing airliner in weeks. If that wasn't bad enough, the field was guarded by Malian Air Force security. No predicting how long he could sit it out before being discovered or expiring from lack of food and water. He resigned himself for a long wait. Not good to hang around during daylight. He moved 100 meters into the desert before stumbling onto a small pit half filled with debris from some long-forgotten shed. He scooped out a depression in the dry sand, climbed in, and pulled several rotting boards over him. The hole could have been filled with ants or scorpions for all he knew, but he was too tired to care. He was asleep within 30 seconds. Roughly manhandled by Massard's crewmen, Pitt and Giordino's wrists were cuffed, and they were forced in a kneeling position by short chains that wound around a steam pipe. They were helplessly confined in the bilge area below heavy steel plating that served as a deck of the engine and power-generating room above. Overhead, a guard armed with an automatic machine pistol slowly paced back and forth, his shoes clicking on the steel floor. They knelt in the dank bilge of the houseboat, their wrists chafing in the tight handcuffs, bare knees below their shorts only a few degrees from being burned by the hot metal flooring. Escape was impossible. It was only a matter of time before they were turned over to General Kazim's security police, and their existence would end with a virtual death sentence. The atmosphere in the bilge was stifling and nearly unbreathable. Sweat streamed out their pores from the damp heat that radiated from the steam pipe. The torment increased with each passing moment. Giordino felt badly weakened and debilitated, his strength almost totally sapped away after 2 hours of confinement in that hellhole. The humidity was worse than any steam bath he had ever sat in, and the loss of body liquids was driving him half-mad from thirst. Giordino looked across at Pitt to see how his self-determined friend was taking this torturous confinement. As far as he could see, Pitt showed no reaction at all. His face, soaked in perspiration, looked thoughtful and complacent. He was studying a row of wrenches that hung neatly in a row on the aft bulkhead. He could not reach them because the chain on his cuffs was stopped from slipping along the pipe by an overhanging brace. He thoughtfully measured the distance that stretched beyond his touch. Every so often he turned his attention to the grating and the guard, then back to the wrenches. "Another fine mess you've gotten us into, Stanley," said Giordino, echoing a line from Laurel and Hardy comedies. "Sorry, Ollie. All in the name of humanity," Pitt said with a grin. "Think Rudy made it? If he stayed in the shadows and kept his cool, there's no reason for him to wind up like us." "What do you think old French Moneybags expects to gain by making us sweat?" Giordino mused, wiping the sweat from his face with his arm. "I have no idea," answered Pitt. "But I suspect we'll know why he stuck us in this hot box instead of turning us over to the gendarmes before too long. He has to be a real sorehead if he's mad over us using his telephone." "My fault," said Pitt, his eyes reflecting mirth. "I should have made a collect call." "Oh, well, you couldn't know the guy is a cheap screw." Pitt looked at Giordino in long, slow admiration. He marveled that the stocky Italian could still summon up a sense of humor despite being on the brink of passing out. In the long, agonizing minutes that followed, their oven-hot cell in the bilge, their ominous predicament, was pushed aside in Pitt's mind as he focused his thoughts on escape. At the moment, any optimism was futile. There was not nearly enough muscle between them to break their chains, and neither he nor Giordino had the means to pick the locks on their handcuffs. His mind conjured up a dozen contingencies, each ready to be cancelled in favor of another. None were workable unless certain situations fell into place. The main hitch was the chains. Somehow or other they would have to come off the steam pipe. If not, Pitt's best-laid plans evaporated before they could get off the ground. He broke off his mental gymnastics as the guard pulled up one of the floor plates and swung it back on its hinges. He took a key from his belt and opened the cuffs attached to their chains. Four crewmen were standing in the engine room. They leaned down and lifted Pitt and Giordino to their feet, dragged them through the engine room, up a stairway, and into a lush carpeted hallway of the houseboat. One knocked on a teak door, then pushed the door wide and shoved the two prisoners into the room. Yves Massard sat in the middle of a long leather couch smoking a thin cigar and swirling a goblet of cognac. A dark-skinned man in an officer's military uniform sat in a facing chair drinking champagne. Neither man rose as Pitt and Giordino stood before them, barefoot, dressed only in shorts and T-shirts, dripping with sweat and moisture.
"These are the pitiful specimens you fished from the river?" asked the officer, regarding them curiously through black, cold, and empty eyes.
"Actually, they came aboard without an invitation," replied Massard. "I caught them in the act of using my communications equipment."
"You think they got a message through?"
Massard nodded.
"I was too late to stop them."
The officer sat his glass on an end table, rose from his chair, and walked across the room until he was standing directly in front of Pitt. He was taller than Giordino, but a good 6 inches shorter than Pitt.
"Which of you was in contact with me on the river?" he asked.
Pitt's expression cleared.
"You must be General Kazim."
"I am."
"Just goes to show you can't judge a person by their voice. I pictured you as looking more like Rudolph Valentino than Willie the Weasel." Pitt crouched and turned sideways as Kazim, his face abruptly flushed with hate, his teeth clenched in sudden rage, lashed out at Pitt's groin with his booted foot. The thrust was vicious and carried most of Kazim's weight behind it. His expression of wrath suddenly turned to one of shock as Pitt, in a lightning move, caught the flailing foot with his hands in mid-flight and gripped it like a vice. Pitt did not move, did not cast Kazim's leg aside. He merely stood there holding it between his hands, keeping the general balancing on one leg. Then, very slowly, he pushed the maddened Kazim backward until he dropped into his chair. There was a stunned silence in the room. Kazim was in shock. As a virtual dictator for over a decade, his mind refused to accept insubordinate and contemptuous treatment. He was so used to people quivering before him, he did not know how to immediately react at being physically subdued. His breathing came quickly, his mouth a taut white line, his dark face crimson with anger. Only the eyes remained black and cold and empty. Slowly, deliberately, he eased a gun from a holster at his side. An older automatic, Pitt observed with remote detachment, a 9mm Beretta NATO Model 92SB. Unhurriedly, Kazim thumbed down one side of the ambidextrous safety and aimed the muzzle at Pitt. An icy smile curled beneath the heavy mustache. Pitt flicked a side glance at Giordino and noted that his friend was tensed to leap at Kazim. Then his gaze locked on Kazim's grip on the automatic, waiting for the slightest tightening of the hand, the tiniest flexing of the trigger finger, bracing his knees to dodge to his right. This could have been an opportunity for an escape attempt, but Pitt knew he had lost any advantage by pushing Kazim too far. His death would be slow and deliberate. It stood to reason Kazim was a good shot, and he would not miss at that close range. Pitt knew he might move fast enough to duck the first shot, but Kazim would quickly adjust his aim and shoot to maim, first one kneecap, then the next. The general's evil eyes did not reflect a quick kill. Then, half an instant away from when the room would explode in gunfire and convulsive bodies, Massard made a flourish in the air with his hand and spoke in a commanding voice. "If you please, General, conduct your execution elsewhere, certainly not in my party room." "This tall one is going to die," Kazim hissed, the black eyes gazing at Pitt. "All in due time, my good comrade," said Massard, while casually pouring himself another cognac. "Do me the courtesy of refraining from bloodying up my rare Nazlini Navajo rug." "I'll buy you a new one," Kazim growled. "Did you consider the fact he might want a fast and easy way out? It's obvious he baited you, choosing a fast death rather than suffering the agony of long-drawn-out torture." Very slowly the pistol dropped, and Kazim's deathly smile turned wolfish. "You read him. You knew exactly what he was about." Massard gave a Gallic shrug. "The Americans call it street smarts. These men have something to hide, something vital. We both might benefit if they could be persuaded to talk." Kazim pushed himself from the chair, approached Giordino, and raised the automatic again, this time shoving the Beretta's barrel against Giordino's right ear. "Let's see if you are more talkative than you were on your boat." Giordino didn't flinch. "What boat?" he asked, his tone as innocent as a priest at confession. "The one you abandoned minutes before it blew up." "Oh, that boat." "What was your mission? Why did you come up the Niger to Mali?" "We were researching the migratory habits of the fuzzwort fish by following a group of the slimy little devils upriver to their spawning grounds." "And the weapons aboard your boat?"
"Weapons? Weapons?"
Giordino made a downward turn of his lips and raised his shoulders in ignorance. "We ain't got no weapons." "Have you forgotten your run-in with the Benin naval patrol boats?" Giordino shook his head. "Sorry, it doesn't ring a bell." "A few hours in the interrogation chambers of my headquarters in Bamako might jog your memory." "Not a healthy climate for uncooperative foreigners, I assure you," said Massard. "Stop conning the man," said Pitt, looking at Giordino. "Tell him the truth." Giordino turned and stared blankly at Pitt. "Are you crazy? Maybe you can stand torture. I can't. The thought of pain makes me ill. If you won't tell General Kazim what he wants to know, I will." "Your friend is a sensible man," said Kazim. "You would be wise to listen to him." Just for a second, Giordino's blank look slipped, then it was back again, only this time it was beaming with anger.
"You dirty scum! You traitor!"
Giordino's verbal abuse was abruptly cut off as Kazim pistol-whipped him across the face, opening a bloody gash on his chin. Giordino staggered two steps backward, then stopped and lurched forward like a maddened bull. Kazim lifted the automatic and aimed it between Giordino's eyes. "Here it comes," Pitt thought coldly, thrown off track by Giordino's bursting temper. Pitt rapidly stepped in front of Kazim and grabbed Giordino's arms, pinning them behind his partner's back.
"Steady, for God's sake!"
Unnoticed, Massard pressed a button on a small console by the couch. Before anyone spoke or made another move, a small army of crewmen surged into the room, their combined mass and weight driving Pitt and Giordino to the floor. Pitt barely had a fleeting glimpse of the avalanche before he tensed for the crush. He went down without fighting back, knowing it was useless, determined to save his strength. Not Giordino, he thrashed like a crazy man, filling the room with curses.
"Take that one back to the bilge," shouted Massard, coming to his feet and pointing at Giordino.
Pitt felt the pressure fall away as the guards concentrated on wrestling Giordino into submission. One of the guards swung a short snapper kosh, a weight on the end of a flexible cable, and cracked Giordino on the neck just below and behind the ear. A grunt of pain and all fight went out of Giordino. He went limp as the guards grabbed him under the arms and dragged him from the room. Kazim pointed the automatic at Pitt, who was still lying on the floor.
"Now then, since you prefer cordial conversation to agony, why don't you begin by giving me your correct name?"
Pitt twisted to his side and sat up. "Pitt. Dirk Pitt."
"Should I believe you?"
"It's as good a name as any."
Kazim turned to Massard. "Did you have them searched?"
Massard nodded.
"They carried no credentials or papers of any kind."
Kazim stared at Pitt, his face a mask of repugnance.
"Perhaps you can enlighten me on why you've entered Mali without a passport."
"No problem, General," Pitt let the words rush out. "My partner and I are archaeologists. We were given a contract by a French foundation to search the Niger River for ancient shipwrecks. Our passports were lost when our boat was fired on by one of your patrol vessels and destroyed."
"Honest archaeologists would be begging like simpering children after being chained in a steam compartment for 2 hours. You men are too hardened, unafraid, and arrogant to be anything but trained enemy agents."
"What foundation?" Massard broke in.
"The Society of French Historical Exploration," Pitt answered.
"I've never heard of it."
Pitt made a helpless gesture with his hands.
"What can I say?"
"Since when do archaeologists explore for artifacts in a super yacht equipped with rocket launchers and automatic weapons?" asked Kazim sarcastically.
"It never hurts to be prepared for pirates or terrorists," Pitt smiled stupidly. At that moment there was a knock on the door. One of Massard's crewmen entered and handed him a message.
"A reply, sir?"
Massard scanned the contents and nodded. "Express my compliments and say he is to continue his investigation."
After the crewman left, Kazim asked,
"Good news?"
"Most enlightening," Massard purred. "From my agent in the United Nations. It seems these men are from the National Underwater and Marine Agency in Washington. Their mission was to hunt down a source of chemical contamination that originates in the Niger and causes a rapid growth in red tides after it enters the sea."
"A facade," sneered Kazim, "nothing more. They were sniffing around for something far more significant than pollution. My guess is oil."
"The very thoughts of my agent in New York. He suggested it might be a cover, and yet his source of information didn't think so."
Kazim looked at Massard suspiciously.
"Not a leak from Fort Fourreau, I hope."
"No, not at all," Massard answered without hesitation. "My project is too distant to impact the Niger." "No, it can only be another one of your many clandestine ventures you haven't seen fit to reveal."
Kazim's face went rigid and lifeless.
"If anyone is responsible for spilling contamination in Mali, old friend, it must be you."
"Not possible," Massard said flatly.
He stared at Pitt.
"Do you find this conversation interesting, Mr. Pitt?"
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"You and your partner must be very valuable men."
"Not really.
At the moment, we're just your everyday garden variety prisoners."
"What do you mean by valuable?" inquired Kazim.
"My agent also reports the UN is sending a special tactical team to rescue them."
Just for a second, Kazim looked shocked. Then he quickly came back on balance.
"A special force is coming here?"
"Probably already on its way, now that Mr. Pitt was able to contact his superior."
Massard glanced at the message again.
"According to my agent, his name is Admiral James Sandecker."
"It would appear there is no fooling you."
The elegant room on the houseboat was cooled by air conditioning, and Pitt shivered uncontrollably after suffering the steamed heat in the bilge. but he was more conscious of a nameless chill. It came as a shock that Massard was privy to the entire mission. He tried to imagine who might have betrayed them, but no one came immediately to mind.
"Well, well, well, we are not so clever and indifferent now that our cover is blown, are we, my friend?"
Kazim poured himself another glass of Massard's excellent champagne. Then he looked up abruptly from his glass.
"Where were you planning to rendezvous with the UN force, Mr. Pitt?"
Pitt was trying to give his impression of a man with amnesia. This was a dead-end street. The Gao airport was too obvious a pickup point. He dared not compromise gun, but he took a long shot in hopes that Kazim was as dumb as he looked. "The Gao airport. They're flying in at dawn. We were to wait at the west end of the airstrip." Kazim stared at Pitt for a brief moment, then suddenly he struck Pitt across the forehead with the barrel of his Beretta.
"Liar!"
he snapped. Pitt ducked his head and covered his face with his arms.
"It's the truth, I swear."
"Liar!" Kazim repeated. "The airstrip at Gao runs north and south. There is no west end." Pitt exhaled his breath in a long, silent sigh and shook his head very slowly. "I guess it would be useless to hold out. You'll get it out of me sooner or later.
Unfortunately for you, I have methods for doing just that."
"Very well," Pitt said. Admiral Sandecker's instructions after we destroyed the boat were to head due south of Gao about 20 kilometers to a wide, shallow ravine. The helicopter is to be flown in from Niger. What is the signal for a safe pickup?" "There is no need for a signal. The surrounding countryside is deserted. I was told the helicopter will scout the area with its landing lights until they spot us."
"What time?"
4 a.m. Kazim looked at him long and pensively, then said caustically,
"If you have lied to me again, you will deeply regret it."
Kazim put his Beretta back in its holster and turned to Massard. "No time to waste. I have to prepare a welcoming ceremony."
"You would be smart, Zateb, to keep the UN at arm's length. I strongly advise against interfering with their tactical team. When they do not find Pitt and his friend, they will fly back to Nigeria. Shooting down the helicopter and killing every man on board will only open a hornet's nest."
"They are invading my country."
"A trivial point," Massard waved his hand. "National pride does not become you. The loss of aid and funding for your, shall we say, nefarious programs would not be worth satisfying a bloodlust. Let them go unmolested."
Kazim gave a twisted smile and a dry, humorless laugh.
"Eve, you take all the pleasure from my life."
"While putting millions of francs in your pockets."
"And that too," Kazim acquiesced.
Massard nodded at Pitt.
"Besides, you can still have your fun with this one and his friend. I'm sure they will tell you what you wish to learn."
"They will talk before noon."
"I'm quite sure they will."
"Thank you for softening them up in your engine room sweatbox."
"My pleasure."
Massard walked to a side door. "Now, if you will excuse me, I must see to my guests. I've ignored them far too long."
"A favor," said Kazim.
"You have but to name it.
Keep Mr. Pitt and Mr. Giordino in your steam room for a while longer. I would like any remaining spirit and hostility melted away before I have them transported to my headquarters in Bamako."
"As you wish," Massard agreed. "I'll instruct my crew to return Mr. Pitt to the bilge."
"Thank you, Eve, my friend, for capturing and turning them over to me. I'm grateful."
Massard bowed his head.
"My pleasure."
Before the door closed behind Massard, Kazim refocused his attention on Pitt. His black eyes blazed with fiendishness. Pitt could only remember once before seeing such concentrated malevolence in a human face.
"Enjoy your stay in the sweat bilge, Mr. Pitt. Afterward you will suffer. Suffer beyond your wildest nightmares."
If Kazim expected Pitt to tremble with fear, it didn't happen. If anything, Pitt looked incredibly calm. He wore the beaming expression of a man who just hit a jackpot on a slot machine. Inwardly, Pitt was rejoicing because the general had unwittingly unraveled the hitch in his escape plans. The gate had cracked open, and Pitt was going to slip through.